everybody. It's election day, at least in a few parts of the country. And believe me, if you're stuck with an election, you probably are complaining rather than bragging. But here we're talking fugitive on KSAV with the usual suspects. It will be the hosts or the... What's the word here? They run the discussion group, Fugitive Views and Reviews. And tonight, we're going to be talking about to toil at many jobs, all of the talents that that Richard Kimball had, in addition to just being a physician. If you want to contribute, 800-407-KSAV, talk at ksav.org. And Bobby Neer, why don't you start things off as usual?
Okay, thanks, Dave. Richard Kimball used to have a profession, a job. He used to get up each day and go to work as a doctor, pediatrician, we are told, although we never see him doing that. And then one day, his career was over. His practice, which we assume took some time to create, simply disappeared. But his need to continue to work not only continued, but increased. Because life on the road, looking for the man you believe killed your wife, and staying one step ahead of the man who wants to end your life, can be pretty expensive. There is a little matter of food and shelter, even if that shelter is usually hardly worth a dime. We have two issues this evening. In the first half of this program, we will deal with Kimball's uncanny knack to fit into any, and I do mean any, job that is available. In the second half, we'll look at the job he was born to do as a physician. Just because he's on the road doesn't mean he isn't still doctoring. First up is the not-so-small matter of how a man with no fixed address, no references, and no Social Security card number he can use manages to get hired anyway. Social Security card and number is that one thing that binds us all together, unless it is you're an illegal alien and get paid in cash under the table, but Kimball hardly fits that profile. I only know one thing. I got my first and only Social Security card and number when I was 16 years old and the fugitive was just beginning on TV. I only got it because my friends were getting after-school jobs and I wanted to join them, and they told me, well, first you have to get one of those Social Security card things. So because the Social Security office was on my way home from school, one day I stopped in and got one. It seemed kind of flimsy to me, so I wrapped scotch tape around it to protect it. And to this day, it resides in my wallet, incredibly, with the same tape still around it. I dare say it has held up a lot better over the years than its owner has. Ken, a few questions about this. How does Kimball do it? I only know of one episode in which this comes up, and that's Terror at High Point in Season 1, where his boss, Jack Klugman, tells him the numbers he gave him don't match up. And furthermore, isn't Kimball going to owe a hell of a lot of back taxes when he finally gets exonerated?
From the opening episode, I had this question, too. How does he get the job, number one, without that Social Security number? That would seem impossible, but you know the very first episode? Remember, he goes into his hotel room. He has a newspaper.
All right.
And he's looking through the Help Wanted ads, and it says bartender. And you know what? I had an immediate question. I wrote this in our book. If you're going to be a bartender, don't you need a license to do that? I know today you just can't get a job as a bartender. You need a liquor license to do that.
I think so.
I thought it was if you owned the bar, you had to have a liquor license. I didn't think you needed a license if you were just going to work there.
Let's say if Dave, he drinks, don't you, Dave?
What's that?
I wanted to ask Dave whether he knew.
Oh, I don't believe you need a license at all to be a bartender. The establishment needs the liquor license.
Oh, okay.
And as far as the Social Security number, back long ago when I got one, I never had to show the card. You just wrote down the number.
Well, yeah, but that's bad enough, having to write the number down.
But again, if he were just making up a number, by the time it ever came back, that, you know, all they would do is credit the withholding to somebody else's account.
Really? Yeah. I wonder about that. That's a good question.
Yeah, it's the government running it.
I thought you needed a license in order to serve drinks.
The owner of the establishment.
Well, it's probably state by state, but so it would depend where it's at. In California, you do not.
Yeah, but not an individual person that you hire. They don't have to be licensed to do that. They just work there.
I'll check on the internet later and see what the laws. Where was he in that? He was in Tucson, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll check later. And next
but you know what? I did question that throughout the series, a lot of his jobs, and you know, as a fugitive, you've got to take a job that keeps a low profile. But you know, many times Richard Kimball took a job that was high profile. You know, even in that episode about the boxer.
Right.
You know, he was the cut man.
Right.
I mean, obviously, you can have a lot of people show up to watch the fight, and they know who the cut man is in between rounds. So
he's right out there in the spotlight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, what if the fight is on TV?
Well,
right.
Good point.
So, you know, Kimball was...
There were Friday night fights on TV back then, yeah.
You also had to know how to mix drinks to be a bartender, too.
Yeah, but I gave him a pass on that because I think he knows how to do that because Richard and Helen were found drinking themselves silly
yeah, right.
at the beginning of the episode. So they probably knew how to drink and mix drinks.
Okay.
I think that was a problem.
But like you said, throughout many, many episodes, you know, Kimball, I don't mind his gas station jobs or the lumber jobs, construction worker.
Truck driver.
Yeah, I'm looking. Well, that's a job I wouldn't have taken as a fugitive because what about police?
Well, yeah.
And then, but the one job that really got me, Bob, is episode 66. He's a chauffeur
for
the high-profile Richard Anderson character who has his poster all over town. And Kimball is a fugitive, yet he's the main chauffeur.
Right. Well, let me tell you the one I have a problem with, and that's the one where he works in the missile silo. He works they're building a missile silo, and he's part of the construction crew. That's the one where he gets stuck underneath. And I'm sorry, but this series takes place in the mid-60s, in the middle of the Cold War, and nobody's going to tell me that even though the missile isn't there yet, that you can get a job on a construction site that has anything to do with national security and not have to go through a rigorous background check. Who in the world would let a strange man get in there? We don't know who he is. He could be a spy. He could do something under there that would make the missile silo absolutely useless in the case we got attacked. So I find that absolutely incredible. I don't think he can pass that one at all. I don't see it. But the other ones, the truck driver jobs, while not very smart, I can see it. He's also a dishwasher a lot of times, since anybody can get that. He's a janitor. Anybody can do that. Kitty, what do you think?
Well, I haven't really seen him do any jobs that I thought were overly outlandish. I've just been surprised in some of the cases how people are so quick to hire him. I mean, that episode, All the Scared Rabbits, Suzanne Plachette opens the door, and in 5 seconds she decides to let this strange guy drive her and her daughter across the country. I mean, it's amazing to me. Obviously, I guess serial rapists and serial killers didn't get as much press back in the 60s.
Yeah, it's automatically assumed that he's so charming that the minute that you meet him, you know, you just go, yeah, this is a great guy. He doesn't have to pass any of the tests that any of us had to pass when we first started working. And it just seems very odd. But this is another one of those cases, like we see in the series all the time, in which we just kind of overlook those things. It's funny, when the writers and the producers can't deal with an issue, they take the easy way out. They simply ignore it. Don't ask us that. He does. Okay, you know what? We really don't have an answer. So best that you not ask that. Of course, that's what we do here. I think that, and there are certain jobs that he has that I don't see where a doctor would have that kind of knowledge. How about the one where he sees the Helen Kimball lookalike working in that nightclub, and he's operating the spotlight? Where did he learn to do that? I mean, I can't do that.
Well, I don't know. The spotlights that he was operating didn't look that complicated. I mean, it's not like she was dancing around the stage.
That's true.
You know, she was just sitting there. Playing a guitar and singing, so all he had to do was keep the spotlight fixated just on her. So that doesn't seem like it would be that difficult.
Yeah,
well, the back of the Fugitive Recapture, Ed Robinson's book, has a list of all the various jobs that he had Now, of course, he's not employed in every episode. Some he's on the run. Some he's not. Some he's injured. You know, we just did May God Have Mercy. He was in the hospital there. And so there are some times when he's not really in a position to be working anywhere. But the only thing I can say is the only way he might get away with this, and I still think it's kind of far-fetched, is the fact that that he doesn't stay around long enough to have any real check done of his records. But I think that in any job, even back in the 60s, if you hand in that number, I think Dave's a little bit lax on this. If you hand in that number, it's going to kick back. I don't think for one minute. I used to work for the Social Security Administration for a while, and those numbers have to match up. We didn't just take numbers and assign them to somebody else because they didn't.
How long would he hold the job though, Bob? By the time they sent him back, he was gone.
Well, yeah, I agree. Okay, well, that's true. Well, do you think he's going to owe any tax when he goes free at the end?
Boy, I'll tell you, now that's one he'll never run away from.
Well, I don't think he would be taxed because, I mean, they don't have any record of him working. He never used his real name anywhere. So how are they going to prove it was him that was actually working?
Wait a minute. You're just assuming that the United States government simply looks the other way when things don't add up. Oh, there's something wrong here. The numbers don't belong to him. They belong to him. He made up numbers. I mean, I can sit here tonight. You got a job for me. It'd take me about 3 seconds to make up some numbers, but either they're not going to match anybody, or there's so many numbers around these days, and they're bound to match somebody. And that's it. It's not going to work that way. I don't care how much time goes by or anything. This is a serious matter. These numbers absolutely have to add up. But, you know, these days we just take it so lightly because it's not a big deal. You go into a job, and when I first started working, people actually asked to see your Social Security. Oh, you have that with you? And you're like, oh, great. Now, of course, nobody cares. Nobody, what do you have? Do you not? I'm sure most people have the slightest idea what their Social Security card is.
Actually, you do have to produce it.
Only a couple of times in my life.
It has to match up.
You have to show proof of your identity and proof that you're eligible to work. And that's one of the pieces of identification that you can show.
Well, see, I don't know what a Social Security card looks like today. Mine is 4 decades old, so I have no idea what it looks like today.
When I got one,
it was just a flimsy piece of paper and had your name typed in it, and that was it. Now today, I don't know. Does it have what a license has? It doesn't have pictures on it or anything.
No.
Well, that's not an ID. That's never been an ID for me. Anytime I needed an ID. You could not fill out your Social Security card. They would look at that and go, that's interesting. So what does that prove? Your picture's not on it.
That's why they ask you to produce some other form of ID.
Exactly.
I mean, that's where Kimball could run into problems because a lot of times, you know, he never had driver's licenses or anything. Because like where I work, you have to show as proof of your eligibility, you can show your Social Security card and your driver's license.
Right. And that's another thing. So he's facing another issue. He certainly does a lot of truck driving jobs and delivery jobs.
That's
and
true.
Like
Where
that.
Is he getting these driver's licenses to
I don't know.
Because he certainly has had his share of truck driving jobs and delivery type jobs. You would think that the employer would be asking to see a valid driver's license.
Especially that episode, End Is But the Beginning, with Steve Younger.
Right.
You know, that boss, you think he would have checked his driver's license.
That's right, because he didn't like him anyway. So he would have said, this is a strange guy, I'm going to look into him and in his background. And
you know, Bob,
don't
you think the intrigue of the Fugitive series is when you tune in each week to find out what job Kimball has?
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, yes, I think that was a part of it, yeah.
But, you know, I agree with you about that one episode, you know, Ticket to Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
And right away I asked myself the question, why are you on a boat going up to Alaska?
Employed on the boat. He was just there as a passenger.
All right. Folks, we're going to take a quick time out. We've got a couple of questions. One, did Richard Kimball ever work as a talk show host? Because believe me, there's nothing required for that job, including talent. We'll take a quick timeout. We'll be right back to find out about the toils of Richard Kimble talking fugitive here on Sherrovision Radio.
Take a look at corruption. You know, it ranges all the way from petty political larceny to grand government theft. And as far as corruption is concerned, I want to make this one point very clear. I worked for the government for 9 months during 1942. Mrs. Nixon worked for the government in San Francisco while I was in service overseas. I am proud of the fact that I once worked for the federal government. I am proud of the millions of fine, good, honest, decent, loyal people that work for the federal government. And I say that the best thing that can be done for them is to kick out the crooks and the others that have besmirched their reputations in Washington, D.C., and that's what we're going to do.
Select the Eisenhower-Nixon team on November 4th.
Okay, the many jobs of Richard Kimble, and to find out a little bit more, I think that you guys have really covered the Social Security card issue in depth. So let's go to Bob and find out what else is new. Okay.
Well, Richard Kimble may not remember his Social Security number, and he may not be able to use it, but he surely does know who he is and what he must do. And so that is, one day he does not. One day, due to an accident, he loses his memory, and is confronted with an impossible situation, finding out just who he is while making sure no one else does at the same time. No less an authority than Ken calls Escape into Black the second best episode of the series. But some people, including me, might call it perhaps the best episode of the series. It features no less than the best guest performance by an actress, a riveting performance by David Janssen, and the incredible sight of Richard Kimble turning himself over to Lieutenant Gerard, to say nothing of his narrow escape from a moving train. It doesn't get much more exciting than this. The absolutely thrilling Escape into Black, Part 1, Acts 1 and 2, 2 weeks from tonight on Talking Fugitive. Well, we've covered the Social Security issues, so let's talk about the job Richard Kimble really does. He does save many lives, often under impossible conditions, and we can admire him for that. But what about that night, the night of the murder? Very famous scene. We've seen it many, many times. Kitty and I have talked about this endlessly off the board and outside this show. We know that Kimble goes away. He comes back. He finds the door open. He walks in and he sees Helen on the floor. And what does he do? He's a doctor. Of course, he goes right over there and wants to see whether she's got a pulse. Is she still alive? Is there something he can do? Can he bring her back to life? So what does he do? Absolutely nothing. He just stands there and makes a face while precious seconds tick off the clock. It's just possible she can be brought back to life. So why is Kimble standing there doing nothing? In the Fugitive movie and in the 2000 remake of the series, Kimble made a strong effort to try and save his wife. But why not here? Why is this? Kitty, I know this has always been a big issue for you and for me. What are your feelings about this?
Oh, well, I think it's really kind of funny because I think on this show, with Kimble as the doctor, and supposedly he goes out and helps all these people, but yet when you actually get into these life-threatening situations, I think Kimble has let more people die than who he's actually saved. The only thing that I can think of is that maybe in the 60s it wasn't considered... Maybe it was considered a taboo thing to show somebody trying to do CPR on a person on TV. Maybe they thought it was just too violent or something to show, you know, somebody, you know, pumping somebody's chest and trying to breathe life back into them. But at the very least, you would think that they would have had Kimball's reaction just a little bit more like a doctor. Maybe come in and say, "Oh my gosh, Helen," you know, and run up to her and take her pulse and, you know, and listen for a heartbeat or something, you know, and at the very least show that much. But we've seen time and time again, you know, it starts there, he doesn't do anything. We've seen him watch people die where he did just absolutely nothing, didn't even try to go get help. I mean, in the classic, probably the worst case that I saw was in the episode where Andrew Prime came back as a different character from his brother. He came back as a real scummy character, and he actually watched Andrew Prime's character kill a guy. You know, he just stood there. He didn't even try to intervene. He just watched him pummel him to death, and then runs out and goes and tells the guy's daughter that her boyfriend just killed her father. So it's, you know, he's very selective on who he helps. I mean, in the garden house, you know, the woman gets shot, the bad sister gets shot, and his great contribution to trying to help her is to put a pillow under her head. You know, and in the Song of the Swan or whatever that was called, it's
Shadow of the Swan.
And, you know, and he does absolutely nothing. He just
stands there and watches her die. Okay, but that kind of excuse might sit well for any of us if we didn't want to be involved, we were afraid, or we didn't know what to do anyway. But he's a doctor. He's sworn to help if he possibly can. Now, I grew up at a time on TV where there were a lot of famous doctor shows on, the way there are today. I don't like them and I don't watch them, but my parents controlled the TV. And things like Ben Casey and Dr. Kildare and Marcus Welby were always on in my house. So I saw enough doctors to know that they would do almost anything to save anybody. They don't do that anymore in real life, but they did then. Kimmel is nothing like that. He's absolutely nothing like that. I don't know that even David Janssen does a very good job of portraying a doctor in this series. I never really buy him as a doctor. He doesn't seem emotional enough. He doesn't seem to be involved enough as being a doctor. In fairness to him, he does save lives. Remember, he saved Amy in that episode when she gets shot. He saves other lives. But these particular instances are really appalling, and you got to wonder why he's just... I think the scene inside the house, the night of the murder, is the most ridiculous one. Now, you know, go to the 2000 series with Tim Daly, and you know what happened there. He ran over to her, he gave her CPR, he gave her mouth-to-mouth. I mean, he was absolutely beside himself.
Instead, yeah, so was Harrison Ford in the movie.
Exactly. Instead, so you've got David Janssen standing there. He's not only just standing there, it's worse than that. He's making a face and screwing up his eyes and going, ew, what is that? Oh, my God, it's a dead body on the floor.
Yeah,
God, it's my wife. What is that all about?
Yeah, as a doctor, I mean, it's like, what, has he never had a patient die before? That's
any doctor will tell you, and any emergency room will tell you, that seconds count, just seconds. 5 seconds, 10 seconds can be the difference between life and death. There's no time to sit there or stand there and make faces. Now, I think if we confronted the producers with this, or the writer, they might say, well, the scene ends right there. You don't know what he did after that because he goes to black. So how do you know what he did? Maybe he ran over there and tried to save her, and maybe he did, but I say it's already too late. Ken, what's your view of this?
The first time we saw that scene was in The Girl from Little Egypt, right? They didn't show it any time before that.
Right.
Right.
And so they're giving us a flashback. I'm mad at the writer of that episode because, I agree, Bob, Kimball storms out of the house. He drives. They spend some time with him at the lake looking at the boy. Then you have that eerie feeling where he's driving back. All right, he sees the one-armed man run from his house. And they stare at each other. And then Kimball frantically, you know, knows something must be wrong, okay? So he drives into the driveway. And as the audience, we're all wondering, all right, what's going to happen, what's going to happen, what's going to happen? And you're right, Bob. All the writer did was to have Kimball open the door, turn his head, and there is Helen sprawled out on the floor. Now, whether she was beaten or strangled or whatever, we don't know. But Kimball grimaces, and why not extend the scene and have Kimball either run over to her, lift up her head, or, you know, like you said, Helen. But just for him to stand there I mean, the audience
doesn't even know for sure. I mean, how does he know for sure that she's even dead when he runs up to the door? I mean, she could have just been seriously knocked out.
Yeah, why did the writer do that for the audience watching? I mean,
could it be that he thought that she was passed out? You indicated that she'd like to tipple a little bit.
Well, then why didn't he go over and find out?
Well, maybe he's used to seeing her in that position, that condition.
Look, if the one-armed man just ran out of the house, right?
Yeah.
So either Helen, how long would she have been dead if he hit her or strangled her?
Not very long.
No, maybe, what, a minute? If the one-armed man is running, of course, we don't know how long he's in the house after whatever happened. So there's so many unanswered questions. So you're right, Bob. Is she dead or is she alive?
Well, and seconds count, and a doctor knows that. I always say this. If this is not an important issue, then why did they change it in the movie in the second series? See, that's what I find interesting. I can sit here and say, well, you know, we're really nitpicking over this. It's not a big deal. Okay, it's not a big deal. Then why did they change it? They go out of their way to make sure that Harrison Ford goes over to his wife, tries to save her life. They go out of their way to make sure that Tim Daly goes over and tries to save his wife. And when you've seen all three of them the way we have, then you can't help but notice there's a significant difference between what David Janssen did in the original series and what gets done later on. All of a sudden, it's like somebody remembered, oh, wait a minute, he's a doctor, shouldn't he be trying to save her life? Oh, we forgot all about that. So that's a very odd thing. And Kitty also mentioned those other episodes. There's Garden House in the first season, in which one of the two sisters in there gets shot. She's laying on the floor, and Kimball's hovering over her. And you say about a minute. If I remember correctly, that's a very prolonged scene. If you look at your watch, it runs several minutes. The woman's laying there, and he is doing what? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Just like they're going, well, I think she's had it. This is really, there's no blood anywhere. Looks like she could be saved. Nope, no chance of saving her there. And Kitty also mentioned Shadow of the Swan, which I believe is in season 3, in which a woman, a crazy woman, jumps into a lake. She's fished out of there by her boyfriend, and she's laying there on the bank there, and Kimball's just hovering over her again, not doing a thing. Now, you know, you can't help but notice that kind of stuff.
Okay,
so,
one minute.
Okay, Bob, I got a main question, and
you need
to answer this. All right, Roy Huggins assigned the profession that Richard Kimball is to be a doctor.
Right.
You think this was a smart decision? I mean, he could have assigned a profession, you know, maybe he's a lawyer, or maybe he's something.
Well, I think he did it because the series is really based on the real life case. I can't remember the name.
Oh, is that why he did it?
I think so. He always denied that it was.
That was smart to make Richard Kimball a doctor?
I think it was because so many episodes are based on him being a doctor. They lead him into other things, and they create conflict. He's a doctor, he wants to help, but he can't, things like that. Yeah, a lot of episodes like that.
Yeah.
I don't think a lawyer would really care one way or the other.
Lawyer wouldn't be caring in a physician. Listen, we're out of time. Ken, get back in and go to work on the Wall of Fame in there. I appreciate you sending me the picture of that as well.
Okay.
In 2 weeks, we're going to be, program will be Escape into Black, part 1, acts 2 and 3.
1 and 2.
I'm
act
sorry?
1 and 2.
Part 1, Acts 1 and 2. All right, a little typo. Stick around. In 1 hour, we'll be talking television with Dave White. Guests will be Wright King and Jan Merlin tonight, so enjoy that show. And we'll see you here in 2 weeks, talking Fugitive on Sherevision Radio.